D3. Number 5A.
Now, we left yesterday the subject on the level of divine science, where we were considering the place value of the synonymous terms on the level of divine science. And we have taken light, and I've seen there consciousness is just engaged in the contemplation that life is one. Always on that level of divine science you have the one. So it is the one life that is under contemplation, therefore not many lives, the one infinite individuality, therefore not the demonstration of lots of cases, but life as one life. Life is here that sense of self-existence, that life exists out of itself, by itself, through itself, as itself, for itself, that self-existence. And so it gives a sense of self-maintenance, self-supporting, all that which has to do that life has within itself isness. It's the isness, the ever-presence of life. Now we come to truth, and here again we must keep that pedal note of the oneness and just hear that here truth is presented as one truth, as the truth itself. Not the truth about this case and about that case and about this situation and that situation. That doesn't enter in the oneness of being. It is just seeing that life, which has been established as the Word of God, is the truth of being. And so, seeing that, we see that really we can always fall back to the preceding category of the Word and see that which the Word contains as the self-existent being is as truth self-expressed. A wonderful sense comes in which says to us that the self-existence in the Christ is the one truth, namely the one self-expression of being. And so we get that sense that we don't have to express life. We don't have to affirm life. We don't have to live life. We don't have to prove life. All that goes right out of the picture. That sense, that burdensome sense, that we have to live Christian science, that goes right out of the picture. Because there we can see that no human can live the one life. That the one life is itself the one truth. And therefore, the one life expresses itself, demonstrates itself out of itself. So it is that sense of self-expression of being. It's truth here as that which is whole. Whole or health. It's the whole truth. The one truth. The whole truth. Self-conscious truth. Truth being conscious of itself. Or we could also say that that which has first been presented in the Word as the Word of life, as the one life, that is conscious of itself. That's the Christ of itself, the truth of itself. It's self-conscious. Oh, the burden is taken away from us, where we have to feel that we have to watch very closely that we are conscious of the truth and affirm the truth and claim the truth and until we get the closest. Yeah? We get just the other feeling of sitting back and accepting the facts which are in being. The facts which are in being, which says the one infinite being, the one life in the world, has a Christ. it expresses itself. It's self-expressed. It's self-affirmed. It's self-demonstrated. It's self-conscious. So that instead of trying to be conscious of the truth, we accept in consciousness the very fact that truth itself is conscious of itself, of the whole truth, the one truth. So here we get the stone of truth in that place value on the level of divine science. Now, what implication can we draw from this for the practice? For the practice, we can now draw the conclusion that really there is but one truth, and therefore, if we know that one truth, that covers everything. That altitude of consciousness, therefore, we do not need to know the individual specific truth about the case, nor the specific individual error about the case. Here consciousness is so universal, so all in all, so all inclusive, that it just can't see that the one life where is the one truth, and that's the truth. And that truth itself. Therefore it's that point where Jesus could heal the multitude. See, from the point of view of the one life, he could see, I don't need to know each individual patient in the multitude who has to be healed. And not knowing each individual case, he could see the Christ about the whole situation, namely, that if he sees the one and whole and only truth, and truth itself, truth per se, that this is the truth about all the cases. No matter how different those patients were and how different the claims humanly seen were of each individual case, that didn't matter to him. He not even had to know it. Because he could see that if he gets the truth, then of the one truth, that's the truth. And that's all that there is needed. And so that one has a feeling that all he needed was to accept the one consciousness. See, the moment we begin to see that truth is consciousness, the one consciousness, that the place value here of truth is the self-consciousness of being, then we don't have that sense that we feel but this individual consciousness and that individual consciousness of each patient should be set aright. Can I convince that individual consciousness of the truth? Can I make the truth clear to that or the other individual consciousness? All that goes out because truth is not split up. It's the one self-consciousness. Perhaps you could capitalize self, the S of the self, so as to distinguish it from the human self-consciousness and see that it is the divine self-consciousness. And seeing that that being is of the nature of self-consciousness, naturally consciousness, or one consciousness. And therefore the question of individual consciousnesses does not enter in. And this is naturally a great relief. So that Jesus, when he healed the multitude, didn't have to know the specific error or the specific claims of each one who were healed. And this is, I think, a most important thing for us to know. Namely, that actually, the moment we touch somehow that state of consciousness, and perhaps we only touch it here and there and have not yet arrived at that point where we just live and move and have our being constantly in that, but the moment one touches that consciousness, one begins to get the proof that it does heal without that we know what needed to be healed. So often we will have in our practice the fact that we heal something without that we are being told what had to be healed, without that we knew that the patient was a patient, that we were perhaps speaking or talking or explaining or moving in an atmosphere which just was the answer to a situation. Without that, we would know that this patient would suffer under claim. Or what I have seen more and more in the recent years, when I was getting nearer and nearer to that structure of that chart, was that people were healed before I knew it. That they would write to me, and it takes perhaps 3 or 4 days for a letter to reach me, and that they were healed before I got the letter. You see, this is not a wonder, a miracle. This is science, because it says that it isn't the practitioner who heals. No practitioner has ever healed a case. It's divine consciousness that does it. Now that divine consciousness is divine consciousness, completely impersonal. And so the more we entertain that wonderful universal sense of the one truth, naturally everyone that reaches out for that truth is touched by that consciousness, not by the practitioner's consciousness, but by the one consciousness of truth. Can you see that? That has nothing to do with the practitioner. I think the more we realize that we as people can never heal a single case, the better we are off. The more we see that it is all divine, impersonal consciousness. So here we get that sense of finding the certainty, see, that whenever we are still within ourselves and are contemplating that one consciousness, that universal one consciousness, that that does heal. No matter if we ever will know who has been healed by that consciousness. Because the world will feel its beneficial effect. And it's not even necessary that we ever will know what that consciousness has done to the world, to individuals, to a situation, to a nation, to any proposition on this world. Therefore, we can see that each one can be a very busy practitioner. That each one, the moment he sees that the one consciousness is the one great treatment that is given, being given constantly in a universal way, that will help the world in untold ways and means. And we inwardly must just have that assurance and joy and certainty that our work has been a terrific blessing, an infinite blessing. We limit ourselves because we say, only then do I bless somebody when somebody comes along and says, will you please help me over this and this problem? And then when you feel you have helped this person over this problem, then people feel they have been a blessing. This is too small. Much too small. Here in Divine Science, we really can see how we can be a universal blessing, so that we feel that our work is worthwhile, that our work in study, our work in devotion, our work in contemplation, our work in stillness, in peace, in quietude, is worth everything. And with that certainty, we should go through our days and through our years. Now, we come to the next one, Christianity. Christianity is here pinpointed through the synonymous term love, the pedal note of oneness, therefore one love. Oh, what a wonderful sense that is. How on earth are we satisfied always by thinking that the highest sense of love is to love God with all our heart, with all our soul, with all our mind, or to love one another, or to love one's enemy? Well, it's certainly something very good, but it isn't really a high sense of love. Really, it isn't. Because if we love God, we go out from the proposition that we are not God-ish, God idea, God in operation. Then we go out from the point that we are somehow outside of God, but are very, very good people. We are such good people that we love God. Or if we go out from the sense that God loves us, it's too small, because it means that God has something outside of himself to which he has a nice, loving relationship. But there is nothing outside of me. So there is actually, in reality, no relationship between God and men by loving men. It doesn't exist. Either being is love, and then being is love. And that's that. That's just that. No use talking around the bush. If being is love, then it is love. Then being is love. Then there is just one love, and that one love really is that coexistence of principle and idea. It's not the relationship of principle to idea. It's the coexistence of principle and idea. And coexistence doesn't mean that what the world calls coexistence, when the Russians and the West coexist and have a thick wall between them and barbed wire and say, I exist on this side and you exist on that side and let's see as we get along, each one by himself. That's not coexistence. Coexistence means that existence is completely at one with one life. It's completely congruent with the one life. And not side by side. So the real sense of coexistence means that the idea coexists with principle as being in principle, as being principle idea. And not just idea somehow separated or ejected, emanated from a central principle. It's always one, coexistence. And so here, if we see that, then we solve the terrific question. Namely, the two most fundamental questions which every religion has is, or perhaps three fundamental questions that it has. First, the question, what is God? The second question, how am I one with that God? And third, how does that God, if I'm one with him, how does that God come to me and be one with me? These are the fundamental questions that run through every religion. Here we have the answer. First, the word states what God is. The second one states where Christ tells us that we are, that there is Immanuel, God with us. And so we begin to realize in Christianity that we do not have to become one with God, nor that God has to come to us, but that our being is living and moving in God, that there is coexistence of principle and idea, coexistence of God and man in the biblical terminology. Therefore, we get here that great sense of love of man being completely integrated into being, a sense of coexistence in being. Therefore, all what we have to do humanly is not through rituals, not through meditation, not through any way try to get one with being, but to accept what already is, namely the coexistence of principle and idea. Accept it, accept it, accept it. My sister was once teaching this in a class, to a class, and then somebody said in the class, "But isn't that too easy?" Well, the most, well, try it out if you can. From morning to night, accept. It's actually very easy. We just have to stick to it. And the difficulty is that all things which are simple are not always so easy for the human mind. Being is very simple for the divine mind. And that very simple being is very complicated for the human mind. So being is not complicated, but the human mind is very complicated when it has to get hold of being. So whenever we feel that something is complicated in science, we just have to remember that it is because we are not reasoning in science, but from a human point of view, from the human mind. Because for the divine mind, nothing is, what is the word, complicated. The divine mind understands itself because it shows the coexistence of principle and idea, principle knowing itself. But the thing is, can we accept that standpoint? Accept here on this level of divine science that there is just one life, one infinite, ever-present isness, self-expressed. Do we accept that? That it is in truth self-expressed, self-operative, self-affirming, self-demonstrating. Do we accept that? From morning to night, have we the joy of accepting that? Are we going through the day with that terrific joy and assurance and trust that by golly nothing is going on but truth affirming itself, demonstrating itself, and seeing in love that there is one love, one fulfillment, one coexistence of principle and idea, so that never is anything going on which is not in line with the divine being. So, in the practice of this Christianity, we can see that here we don't need to protect ourselves against something. You know, the Christian scientists are very busy in doing protective work. In doing protective work for the church against Roman Catholicism and this and that. Doing protective work for every lecture against this and that and the other. Doing protective work for the reading room against this and that and that. Doing protective work as a practitioner against malpractice and so on and so on. Oh, what a blow. What a blow. It means that we are afraid of something else. It means that we have accepted that there exists another power. That's what we do. But if we have a sense of one love and the consciousness of one love, then that is the self-protection of itself. No one of us can protect Christian science, can protect truth. How could we? is truth so small that it needs our little human beings and our limited understanding to protect it? Couldn't we accept that truth is self-protection, or that love is its own self-protection, because truth is only knowing itself, it's self-conscious of itself. Therefore, we see there is one love which is showing that there is no accuser there. The Christian scientists usually live in an atmosphere of feeling constantly accused, constantly under the pressure of an opposite world. That horrible world of the medical people, that horrible world of the hospital, that horrible world of the physicist, that horrible world of the biologist, that horrible world of everything. Why? Why? If we see that there is one, then we keep that universe as one and make not a diverse out of the universe. It's consciousness. And so we can see that in that one love we have the coexistence of principle and idea, therefore love's own achievement. In our practice, therefore, we don't feel that we have to achieve something. Love has here that pedal note of self-achievement, self-fulfillment. And so we are really relieved of the responsibility to achieve something with our practice. You know, it gives quite a different practice the moment we don't feel that we have to heal these and these people, that we have to solve this and this problem the way they want it to be solved. And when we can actually have a higher plane in consciousness, where we see that love has its own plane, and that plane surpasses every material conception, surpasses every wish, every desire, every sense of good, surpasses the highest sense of the divine, human sense of the divine. And then we are willing to let go, not to interfere into anything which love wants to work out. Remember how Mrs. Eddy, when she was asked how she could heal a case instantaneously, she said, "I put Mary out of the way." She put the whole responsibility out of the way. She put the whole sense out of the way that she had to do something, that she had to achieve something. Think what freedom we would gain if we would see that the plan of love is million times bigger than what we think it is, and therefore are willing to let the divine plan work out its plan and not our plan. I remember reading how Mrs. Eddy was teaching, that's quite interesting, how Mrs. Eddy was teaching how to heal in her classes up to 1888 or 89 when the Sorry, I don't know exactly then. I think it was 1888 when she gave the last class at the Metaphysical College. And she would teach there always that to heal was to realize the ever-presence of love. See? To realize the ever-presence of love. Then, 10 years later, when she called that extraordinary class, which only lasted for 2 days, I think, those 70 people, 10 years later, she was asking the class, how would they heal the sick? And so all of them naturally were well prepared and didn't know the lessons very well, and so they all answered one after the other and said, well, to realize the ever-presence of love. And so Mrs. Eddy apparently just nodded and nodded and nodded and then said, yes, you have answered very well, but you haven't come near or close enough to the fact. And she said, it is just love. Can you see that at that point she began to touch divine signs in her teaching? That up to that point she was teaching really only Christian science and absolute Christian science, because she couldn't go further than that. But in that class she began to teach divine science, because she could see that realizing the ever presence of love is using, so to say, our human understanding of what love is. And that's not big enough. See, that's not big enough. She could see that that what is healing and is health or is fulfillment is love. Just bluntly, love. Love as that symbol which stands for completion, for perfection, for consummation of everything, for perfection, for instantaneous integration of everything into a whole. That's what her sense of love. And so that doesn't need to be realized. It is. It is, therefore, that acceptance, so to say, within ourselves, that love is love. And have that wonderful consciousness of accepting what love is. And not trying to realize to our understanding what love is. Can you feel how that level of divine science lifts us right above the human understanding of God? Because it's divine science. Yeah. Now, let's go further to science. There we have it pinpointed as principle love. That is, that's how Mrs. Eddy describes the fourth sight, namely where she says that in divine science the essence is life, truth, and love, and these three constitute the divine person, principle, love. So, in principle love, the word Christ and Christianity is gathered together as one person, or Father, Son, and Mother is gathered together as one person and lifted out of the biblical sense into the scientific sense as principle love. Why is it principle love and not just principle? Because here she begins to see it, because it is divine principle. No, I didn't put divine principle. I really should have put there divine principle love, because we have seen on the level of science it is the infinite principle, just the one scientific fundamental basic principle of being. Here she gives the divine nature of the principle and gives therefore a sense that that divine principle is that principle which in the oneness of being integrates everything into the divine principle. It is not just principle as per se, but it's principle that says, I'm the principle that integrates everything into the one principle. It is that principle where we see in human experience what is happening today, or what is coming about today, namely that every science has its principle, and that they begin to feel that because everyone has a principle and is working in its own field and being in watertight compartments, that they have disintegrated the one being, that they have disintegrated man by splitting him up in all sorts of sciences. Man can be looked at from the science of anatomy, from the science of physiology, from the science of medicine, from the science of psychology, from the science of sociology, from the science of biology, from the science of chemistry, from the science of ethics, from every angle can that one man be considered, and every time we split him up into a little, tiny little part. That's what is called the atomization of man or of being. And today science begins to realize that there should be the other trend, the opposite trend taking place, namely to integrate all this science in order to have one being, one man. It's that call for a completely new anthropology. How do you call it? Anthropology. Anthropology.